Needless to say, the news media has a huge influence on society, as we all know. Today's news media is in many ways as fractured and divided as the country is politically. We tend to criticize, quote unquote, the media as if it's one thing. But as a member of the news media, I can tell you firsthand that the news media is actually individual people making individual decisions every day. These individuals face a variety of pressures, from bosses that want a certain story or want it a certain way, to sources who either won't talk to you or won't leave you alone because they want to talk so much, to competition, to deadlines. Trained reporters in the news media have a code to check facts, real facts, not so-called alternative facts, and to verify or source our sources. And the news is also a business. Because today's world moves so rapidly and there are so many media outlets, being a journalist, being a news executive or editor or producer is a juggling act. The news media does not generally like to cover itself, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon. Stories and events where news outlets are the topic or journalists are the topic are always, well, awkward. And editors and producers shy away from them. But today, we're going to dive into this challenge and talk about how the news media does its work, including how they cover women, how they cover thorny issues, and how they cover climate change, with one of the top leaders in the industry for decades. She has been in nearly every role and driven major change in many news organizations, local and national alike. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative professional women, especially in energy, climate, sustainability, and diversity-related issues. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, new technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts and on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you want to gain insight from more women like me and our accomplished guests, join one of our mastermind groups. We'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money as you grow your career or your business, no matter what industry you're in. We need reliable, factual information in order to make decisions in our lives. At a time when there are an almost unlimited number of information sources, it's important to have unbiased people finding out what we need to know. That is the vital role of reporters in society. We shine a light on injustice and crime and tell stories about extraordinary acts of kindness and creativity, too, and of course, the world of business. Yet, society at large today seems to have a kind of love-hate relationship with the press. It's the proverbial, we can't live with them, but we can't live without them. We question their sources, information, and biases at the same time we rely on their information. The media is under attack from all sides. From a business perspective, its ability to generate revenue is being threatened. The current president of the United States calls the press the enemy of the people, and reporters who report on his lies have been threatened by unruly members of his following. And autocrats across the globe are jailing and physically attacking and killing journalists, like the brutal murder of Washington Post columnist and Middle East expert Jamal Khashoggi. So today we're going to get the view from inside the media executive suite from a woman who has been there, done that in many cities around the country. I'd like you to meet Wanda Smalls-Lloyd. Wanda was a senior editor at USA Today, where she managed a staff of over 400 people and five corporate budgets totaling tens of millions of dollars. She was also executive editor of the Gannett-owned newspaper in Montgomery, Alabama, managing editor of the Greenville, South Carolina News, and a production manager at the Washington Post, to name a few roles over her 30-plus year career in journalism. She is also a major champion of diversity in the newsroom, serving on the boards of the National Association of Minority Media and chair of the Association of Newspaper Editors Diversity Committee, and the inaugural executive director of the Freedom Forum Diversity Institute at Vanderbilt University. She has also served on the esteemed Pulitzer Prize jury that awards those prestigious awards, and recently wrote a terrific book about her own evolution as a reporter and news leader. At the same time, the country and the media business were going through their own massive changes. Without further ado, welcome to Green Connections Radio, Wanda, and thank you for joining us. I'm pleased to say Wanda joins us live here in person in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Joan. Good to see you again.
Appreciate it. How is the news business doing in your view today?
I think the news business, for the most part, is doing an awesome job of covering some very important events. You know, we're the fourth estate, so we make sure that we are held accountable to our listeners, our viewers, our readers, and our online users. I still say our, even though I am retired now. After more than 40 years in daily newspaper newsrooms, it's hard to sort of shed that that feeling of being there. But I think we're doing a great job.
Once a reporter, always a reporter, right? How do you think the news media is covering the 2020 election so far?
Well, I'm not sure the news media is covering it as opposed to reacting to it. You know, it's covering what's going on, but so much other stuff is out there, and you know what I mean. It's not all just about the election. Also, with so many candidates, it's really, really hard to be on top of everything that's going on. And so as the candidates themselves whittle things down on the Democratic side, of course, and then we'll have to see what happens on the Republican side.
How do you think reporters can and should keep their own personal preferences and biases in check in their reporting?
Well, I came from a generation where in newsrooms, we never really talked about who we were voting for or which positions we were taking, even in community elections, because we always felt that our job was just to be objective and to cover what's going on. Now we have, in some cases, a splintering of the media. And so you can see on television especially, but and really always in columns, because you've always had conservative columnists and liberal columnists, and so those are always self-identified. But in terms of covering the news, it has changed a little bit because some networks are known as a liberal network, and you know that some are known as a conservative network. And so it's changed a little bit. And I kind of regret that. You know, we came from an era where, and I hope we still are, where none of us ever, ever, ever would consider giving money to a political candidate or putting a bumper sticker on our car or a yard sign.
Some of them you can tell even from the stories they cover and from the headlines that what their bias is, right, what their preference is. And both sides, if you will, of what people think of as the progressive media or the conservative media also have quote-unquote true reporters who just cover the news in their stock. But do you think that these biases have an influence, or these preferences have an influence in the stories they choose or the topics they cover, or, for example, whether they cover women differently or minorities differently, or whether they cover, you know, business people differently?
You know, journalism has always, unfortunately, been a subjective career or process because we are human and we do select the kinds of stories that are covered. And then we select the kinds of stories that go on page one in newspapers or lead the news. So it is a subjective thing, and it does come from sometimes our own experiences. But some of it now, and I think a lot of it now, is coming from polling, from data in broadcasting, especially ratings, I guess, make people make some decisions about what to do or how to cover events. That's regrettable, but it is a subjective process.
One of the issues in the 2020 campaign, and near and dear to our heart on Green Connections, is climate change. How do you think the news media is covering climate change? And you have a really interesting perspective because you have both experience as a national news executive and as a local news executive and reporter. So what's the difference, and how do you think they're doing in that?
I think as much as the media can, they are keeping climate change to the forefront. You know, there's so much noise out there, and by noise, I mean there's so much daily breaking news that the national media is chasing. And so it's difficult to keep on top of it. But when there are things to report, I think they're doing a good job. As far as local news is concerned, my perspective is that there are environmental issues that are affected by climate change that are very important to people on a local level. I live in a coastal community, so beachfront stories about erosion of beaches and the dunes and all that, those are very important things in our community. Yeah, I think there's some data that shows that the ocean is changing, the coastline is changing in a lot of places, but I don't think that they're being covered on a local level based on climate change. It's really based on everyday issues in local communities, and as a local mayor, council member, for example, do we have the money to take care of this problem, and how can we take care of it now, meaning the next 2 years, 5 years, because it affects tourism, it affects the economy, it affects a lot of things, not to mention the places that we live and people who want to spend time on the beach. So those are the kinds of things that are very important on the local level, and I think the people in the communities really appreciate that and understand that, because it affects their taxes, because if they have to clean up certain things, in Montgomery, we covered a Superfund site, and that was very important during that time. That's not necessarily climate change, but those kinds of environmental issues are just very important to local people.
Well, it's certainly energy, that's for sure. That's a really good point. So you find that they're really covering it as economic development or public health or city budget, county budget, state budget, because on a local and state level, they have to balance their budgets. They can't just, write another check and do another continuing resolution, right? So I think that that's actually a good thing, because it brings it home to people. Instead of talking about it as this kind of ethereal thing out here that's going to happen down the road, it says this, and this is happening today, mm-hmm. right? And these are sea level rises that are affecting the communities today. What do you think, if you were in an executive role in the media today, what would your game plan be to make things delivering as solid information to your community, be it national or local, as you possibly could?
Well, I think this is it's an economic issue, first of all. So it's a two-way street. We have to have our public support, our journalism. And without that support, we can't get the advertising, and the advertising really pays for the media in terms of resources, staffing and location and equipment. And equipment plays into it a lot, because a lot of the technological changes have really increased the cost of doing journalism. So the first thing, I think, is just to look at the economy and look at the economics of journalism. Second, obviously, is getting the right people in the right places, engaging people in communities. And I'm really talking about community journalism right now, not necessarily the national and international media, but engaging the people who live in the communities, having town hall meetings, having listening sessions, and understanding what's important in the community is really important. And then I guess I would say diversity is very important. I'm not talking about having a person of color to cover news about people of color, or having women or gays and lesbians to cover issues about women or people who are gay and lesbian. I'm really talking about having a diverse workforce and educating everyone about how to cover all issues and all communities. And that's something that the media has really struggled with. I came from a time when there was hardly any people of color in newsrooms. And then when we started getting more people in of color in newsrooms and women, we kind of pigeonholed them into categories and say, okay, you go over here and you cover fashion. Well, I'm a woman. I like fashion, but that's not everything that I like. And so it's very important to have conversations about who covers what and give people opportunities to cover stories of depth. We lost a lot of people in the media because they were unhappy or dissatisfied with what they were doing, not given top assignments, even though they were qualified, in some cases overqualified. And that hurt us a lot, because once people started rising in their careers and realized, well, I can take what I've learned in journalism and go to law school or go to work for a niche publication instead of a general interest publication. That was something that hurt us a lot. Of course, the economy hurt also. And as the economy comes back, and I'm really happy to see that the economy is strong these days, I'm hoping that those people who are in charge of those budgets, like I was in charge of at USA Today, are really investing in the journalism. And some are. You know, the Washington Post is doing, I think, a great job of investing in their journalism. That's just one example of a company that's investing. But then there are companies that are, you know, there's so many mergers, and every time there's a merger in any industry, there are so many layoffs, and we're losing really good people.
Yeah, there's been a huge hemorrhage. And also, as you know intimately, the local media has really been hemorrhaging. And by the way, thank you for that perfect segue, because there's some really scary statistics from the Women's Media Center. Men receive 63% of bylines. This is current. This is 2019. Men receive 63% of bylines and other credits in print, internet, TV, and wire. Women receive 37% even today. When it comes to reporting on politics, print is 66% male, 34% female, and women still lead, as you point out, in lifestyle, leisure, and health. Of the mainstream media, the anchors and reporters, even though we see wonderful people like Judy Woodruff and others out there, it's still 64-36 in favor of men. At least MSNBC and HuffPost are almost 50-50. All the others are about 70-30. The Wires and AP, et cetera, and it's even worse when you look at editors, managers, and et cetera, and people of color. You worked tirelessly to change this, to put it gently. But here we are, more than 30 years later, and we're still having this problem. As you wrote in your book, quote, "It does not do much good to build a diverse workforce that includes women if consideration and compassion for uniqueness of these individuals is not part of the equation." What do you mean, and how do we change this?
Well, women want to be considered journalists, not women journalists. That's the first thing. But let's be real about it. Women have a lot of responsibilities outside of the workforce, and that's not changing. As a family person myself, a wife and a mother, it was very important for me to spend time with my daughter when she was growing up. But I also had this huge, huge responsibility at USA Today. And so it meant figuring out how to balance those things. Work-life balance is really, really important. But we need editors and leaders in news organizations to understand that women really have two jobs. And I think it's changing a little bit, because I think men are realizing that they need to step up for those who are family people, and so many are, and so many are doing a much better job. But it really takes having women in leadership positions, I think, to help make that happen. Not just because it's the right thing to do, and it is, but because as women, we have connections and we know where to find people. And so if there is a big, I don't know, political beat that needs to be covered in a news organization, we are in organizations outside of the newsroom where we are getting to know people. You know, there's JAWS, Journalism and Women's Symposium. You know, you mentioned that I was a Pulitzer juror four times. Not many women get Pulitzer Prizes. You know, it's not balanced. That's because women aren't given the opportunity to cover those very, very important stories that are positioned for being nominated first and then winning the Pulitzer Prize. And so that's very important. But it doesn't even start at Pulitzer, because that's the top, or Peabody in broadcasting. It really starts at the local level. You know, am I positioned to get assignments early in my career so that I can win regional awards and state awards? And then as I move up to the national level, am I positioned to get the Pulitzer, to be nominated for the Pulitzer Prize? Am I positioned to get the assignments and then be nominated for those kinds of things? And those things lead to also to roles in leadership in news organizations. That's where the decisions are being made.
That's a really good point. And it happens in corporate America. We talk a lot on the corporate side of women not being given the assignments or put on the client engagements that would position them for career advancement.
It's called a pipeline.
Right. But what you're saying is it's the same thing. It's the kinds of stories that they're assigned. And sometimes women want to do a story and the editor says no.
Yes.
Obviously, Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey had great support in doing the Harvey Weinstein story, but even Ronan Farrow, who's a guy, was doing the same story, and he was nixed at another organization to try to do it. So sometimes these stories that have to do with women are also sidelined, which is really unfortunate. But your point about positioning people is really, really critical. Do you think women cover stories differently or women cover different stories?
I do think sometimes that women have different questions. And that's part of the coverage. You know, before we go report any story, you sit down and you write a few questions so that you can make sure that your interview is going to yield the kind of important information germane to the story that you're covering. So it's a matter of who's asking the question sometimes. It shouldn't always have to be that way because, you know, I hope we have a world someday when everyone has a sensitivity for all kinds of stories, not just women, but people of color and all the diverse groups that I mentioned earlier. That's really when we can say we're successful with diversity. It's not just seeing women's faces or people of color when they come to cover something. It really is, how do we educate everyone to be sensitive to all kinds of stories? You know, this is not a women's story, but if you'll allow me to tell this quick story, when I was executive editor in Montgomery, there was a Saturday when there was a Klan rally. Believe it or not, we were still having Klan rallies in the 2000s in front of the Southern Poverty Law Center building. And since it was a Saturday, I sent our Saturday general assignment reporter, who happened to be a black male, to cover this. And then the TV stations, my reporter came back and told me Monday, guess what? The TV stations all sent their black camera people and reporters to cover this Klan rally. And so the Klan's people, when they stood up to do a press conference, were like, oh my gosh, what's happened here? But just, you know, everybody needs to be able to cover everything. That's the point I'm trying to make. And I didn't look around my newsroom and say, who's sympathetic to the Klan or who can get the best information from the Klan? I sent the people whose responsibility it was to cover the news on that given day, and it happened to be a black male. It really has to be that way for men and women, that everybody can cover everything and understand the issues. Is that ever going to happen? I don't know, because as a mother, if I was covering something, an issue that has some interest to women, I'm going to be concerned about my daughter's future. You know, what are the things that are going to impact her life? The economy, the environment, the all kinds of social issues. I'm going to be really concerned about that because that's my legacy. And so surely I'm going to think about that. Would my husband ask the same question or anybody else's male family member ask the same question? I'm not sure we're there yet, but I'm hoping that we get to that world someday.
Well, and the reality is that different people ask different questions because they've had different experiences.
Absolutely.
It's irrelevant of their gender or race or even religious
Absolutely.
Background.
You know, we go back and talk about the environmental issue with climate change. You know, my experience living in a coastal community is that's what I think about because of the coast, and that's our economy. Someone who lives in the middle of the country might think about wheat fields or, you know, dust storms or things like that.
Speaking of being a woman in the news business, you had, I just want to get down to brass tacks here. You navigated the white male dominated world of the news business, and it was even 10 times more white male dominated at the time you were in your growing your career.
Right.
And frankly, it's more diverse now in large part because of your efforts, frankly, and I really say that with great respect and gratitude. But you're a woman of color. How did you manage these environments that were basically set up to keep you down, and you kept growing and growing and growing and finding a way to excel? And in fact, you changed the newsrooms and the news business by increasing diversity and continuing to be a champion for that. What went through your head? How were you making decisions? Talk about that.
Well, I didn't have role models in journalism as a young person, but I did have a role model in business. My mother was in business. She was a senior executive buyer for the Army and Air Force Exchange Service. And so she had navigated those waters to become a top level buyer, you know, in the world, really. And after she retired in 1978, she did an early retirement. She was 50 some years old. We had lots of conversations about how she navigated that. And every time I reached a stumbling block or an obstacle, we would just, you know, we would get on the phone and talk about, well, you know, this is happening because of the men, you know, like an example is I'll say something in a meeting and everybody will go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then some man will say the same thing and everybody in the room goes, well, yeah, that's a good idea. Then somebody says, well, wait a minute, Wanda had that idea first. Why is it a good idea now? Those are the kinds of things. Secondly, I had a very good mentor. His name is Ron Martin, who I worked with at two newspapers, who encouraged me, strongly encouraged me to get involved in organizations that could make those changes happen. One of them was the American Society of Newspaper Editors. And so positioning myself in that organization by leading the diversity committee, for example, that's a committee that really monitors how many people of color and women are we getting in newsrooms? How are we working on retention issues? What are the issues that keep them from succeeding, that keep them from getting the best assignments, that keep them from rising to the top levels? Those are the issues that we were dealing with. That was one of the issues. It was also networking. And I learned very early that networking is very, very important. I have a friend, I was talking to a friend who's not a journalist on the phone, someone I've known since high school, since elementary school, really. And as I was driving to the airport to come to Washington, she said, girlfriend, you can work a room. Because I took her to a business event once, and she said, you know how to work a room. She was a teacher, and she'd never had that experience, and she'd never seen anybody doing that very well. And so learning how to network is very important, and using those opportunities is very important because it opens doors beyond where you are. And so by networking within my own industry, within my own company, the Gannett Company, I knew people in another organization that positioned me to lead the Diversity Institute in Nashville. And so that's where I had more impact because I could actually train and bring people of color and women into the business and train them. These were not college students. These were second career people. And so the networking, the joining organizations, the working in organizations, getting to know people at a personal level, those are very, very important. And we have to really push more young people to understand that they can't just go off and do their job 9 to 5 or 8 to 4 or whatever time it is and go home and consider that they are successful in their careers. It really takes more than that.
Well, it's a couple things in this. First of all, a lot of people think, oh, well, they know what I'm doing. They're on top of what I'm doing. It's like, no, they don't. No, they haven't a clue. They have way too many decisions. But I want to drill down a little bit on something you said, and you can segue this perhaps into advice for mid-career women. I'm the queen of networking also. And I've had people say to me, can I follow you around? Which is really interesting to say, to hear. But it's not just getting somebody's business card and saying, hi, I'm, you know, Wanda Lloyd, how, you know, this is blah, 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 or striking conversation. There's also follow-up steps. So how do you convert a networking opportunity into a paying gig or a referral for a paying gig?
Well, you know, it's so much easier now than it was when I was emerging and growing in my career, because you've got all this social media and the connections are so much easier. You don't have to necessarily pick up a phone and call somebody like I did, or get on a plane and go to a meeting or visit someone like I did. You can now, you know, do follow-up on email. I was at a social slash business event last night, and you know, I've already sent emails to some people saying it was nice meeting you. Here's some information about me. I've recently written a book and it's going to be published in February, and so I'm trying to get the word out because I want people to read the book. You talk about mid-career women. I really wrote that book. It's called Coming Full Circle, From Jim Crow to Journalism. I really wrote this book for mid-career women. That was my first audience in my head as I was writing. I wanted people to understand some of the concepts we're talking about, the networking, the follow-up, the kinds of obstacles that you'll face and how to get over them, the work-life balance. All those things are things that motivated me. And so following up on networking is very important, whether you do it on Twitter, on email. You can pick up the phone and call. That's okay, too. But, you know, for me, the next step after meeting someone and getting their business card or putting their information in my phone is to send them the press kit immediately and say, oh, by the way, I have this book. Here's what's, you know, here's some information. Oh, by the way, I'm open to coming and speaking at your fill in the blank, your university, your business club, all those kind of book clubs, those kinds of things in terms of the book. It really is about follow-up. It's about following people on social media and commenting and saying, oh, yeah, that's, you know, that was nice information that you gave, or that's, I agree with that, or, you know, if it's on Instagram, say, I like the hat you're wearing, whatever it is, really following up and getting to know people on a personal level. It really does pay off to get to know people on a personal level. You cannot, and I go back to what I said a few seconds ago, you cannot be successful without those extending your work day to doing other things on your own time. Now, you know, don't get in trouble with your human resources department about hours if you're an hourly employee. I understand that too. But in terms of personal branding, and that's really what we're talking about, because your brand helps to get you to the next level. And so early in my career at USA Today, I took a couple of days course with a woman named Deborah Tannen, who wrote a book. What was it?
Women Talking 9 to 5. I happen to know Deborah. She's great.
There was a book before that, I think. But anyway, it was
Women. You mentioned it in your book, too.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, she taught us how to network. She taught us how to shake hands, how to look people in the eye, what side to put a name tag on so that people see it when they shake your hand, where to position yourself in a room so that you can ask questions. Don't sit in the back, sit in the front. Ask questions. That's the most important thing, and ask good questions so that people remember you. And so there are lots of tips out there about how to brand yourself and position yourself so that somebody in a newsroom, for example, or in a news organization will say, you know, I bet Joan could cover that story because she asked that good question, and I think she has an interest in that, whatever that subject is. So it really is personal branding and follow-up.
And volunteering and saying, and in the news context, it's pitching stories,
yes.
Right? In a business context, you can still use the same skill. You can even use your writing and communication skills if you're in another job to say, hey, can I, you know, I want to write a blog about this for the company website. And that builds your brand too. And then you can post it on LinkedIn or Medium or wherever, to your point.
And so planning your career trajectory is very complex because you have to think about all those things. Again, it goes back to branding. It goes back to what is expected of me. I had a young man come in my office when I was at USA Today. He was, I think he was a news assistant, but he was aspiring to be a journalist and he wore dreads. And I said to him, I hate to tell you this, and I really don't want you to take it the wrong way, but I don't think you're going to get to do what you want to do with the hairstyle you have. It's not about what's in your head. It's about the perception of the people when you go interview for a job or you try to, you know, get an assignment. That's a perception. You know, he didn't argue about it. He went off and he thought about it. Maybe a year later, I saw him, because he was a summer intern or something like that. I saw him at a professional meeting of some kind, and he had a short haircut. And he said, "Mrs. Lloyd, I want you to know that now I am a reporter covering whatever it was he wanted to cover." He eventually went to law school. And I heard from him a couple of times over his career since then, thanking me for the advice. Now, he may have dreads now. That's okay. Because once you get there, wherever there is, you can pretty much do what you want.
And what I love is that you actually told him that, because a lot of people will say, "Oh, well, I wish they didn't X," but they won't tell you.
Well, you know, that goes back to diversity. I don't think a white manager would have told him that, and I get that. And it's, you know, I was in a position, literally and figuratively, where I could have that conversation with him. You know, it's almost like a man not saying to you, "Well, you know, you shouldn't wear low-cut dress or a dress that's too short or whatever if you're going to cover the mayor's office or something like that." A man can't tell you that. But a woman in a position to send you on those assignments can say, "Well, you know, you might want to think about today, because you're going to the mayor's office wearing something a little bit different." And I have told women that. There was a teacher that I had in high school who told us that. She told us, and I think I have it in the book, you know, "You need to wear undergarments that don't enhance the jiggle in your walk." I'll just put it that way.
I love that. That's brilliant. That's great. You know. So thank you so much. This has really been terrific. I appreciate what you've done for women and for the news business, and for bringing a diversity of perspectives and stories and questions to the news media, which is such a critical foundation of the United States, but really of the globe and of the society's well-being writ large. So thank you so much for that.
And thank you. It's always a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk about these very critical issues.
Well, I like to get real with people. You know, not everybody gets to these brass tacks, right? So thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio. Wanda Lloyd, a former top news executive and diversity advocate, as you could tell. So where do you get your news from? Where do you trust your news from? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page. And find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, wherever you found us today, and on Apple Podcasts, etc. GreenConnectionsRadio.com is our website, and you can go there to find out about our mastermind groups as well. Thank you for joining us. I'm Joan Michelson. See you next time.